I was introducing last time some issues with regard to environmental ethics. And I've tried to do this by trying to motivate you by talking about the environmental crisis. And I was doing this by trying to give some concepts of the environmental crisis. I gave two concepts. One of them was a little bit more precise. One of them was rather vaguer. I'd like to try to sharpen up those concepts a little bit today. And I should also like to go through those four levels of explanation in a little bit more detail, or rather to fill in some blanks that I couldn't do. And then that'll take a little bit of this lecture. And then I would like to begin talking about a particular view, a particular response to the environmental crisis, called biocentrism. And this is a particular theory of environmental ethics, and it's due to Paul Taylor in a book called Respect for Nature. It's an interesting book. It's written by a philosopher, and therefore, so to speak, a lot of the bits and pieces are discussed in considerable detail. It's kind of a wild view. Do we really want to be nice to, do I want to be nice to the elephant grass in my garden, really? Do I care about plants? Well, maybe we can make a case for that. I read this a couple of years ago quite briefly and thought, well, he's crazy. Then I thought I'd better read it a little bit more detail, and I decided he wasn't crazy after all. So I think he's worth thinking about, Paul Taylor. That's one response. Paul W. Taylor, it's on your reading list, called Respect for Nature. It should be in reserve. That's one way to respond to the environmental crisis, by developing an environmental ethic. Another way is to base one's thinking on ecology. That's a second way to respond to the environmental crisis. A third way, which I don't think we'll get to do, but if you really want to do it, we can do it, is to have a look at some of the feminist responses and feminist environmental ethics. I was searching around for some years to find something that I found to be coherent, and I don't consider the work by Freya Matthews particularly coherent. She's one feminist, been writing about this, but recently Val Plumwood's written another book, and I think Val Plumwood's account is quite interesting. So if you really want me to get onto that, I wasn't intending to, but I can talk about that at some stage. I had two concepts of the environmental crisis I talked about last time. The first concept was that this was a crisis for us. The sorts of trends that I put up on the board based upon the Club of Rome's forecasts, where we had increasing resource depletion, increasing pollution and so on, seemed to suggest that the environment in which we live is no longer an environment which is as nice as it used to be from our point of view. It's polluted, we're getting more cancers, more environmentally caused diseases, we're finding it harder to get resources, we're not living in such a pleasant sort of place, the cities are smelly and nasty, and so on. That's one sense of environmental crisis. It's a crisis for us. It's a crisis for us as members of Homo sapiens. It might even be crisis for the species Homo sapiens. That's one conception of the environmental crisis. It's bad for us. And I suggest to you, that's the usual conception of the environmental crisis. When somebody says, there's an environmental crisis, you can say either, well, no, there isn't, or yes, there is. And if you say, yes, there is, then your response seems to indicate that you think that it's a crisis for us, for members of Homo sapiens. That's, of course, taking the anthropocentric view. Anthropos, Latin for man, I think. Centric, center. Man in the center, me in the center, guys like us in the center, humans in the center. Don't care about anybody else, don't care about anything. Anthropocentric. That's the first conception of the environmental crisis. If that's the only conception that we had, there might be certain sorts of ways to respond to it, which wouldn't be available if we had a different way of thinking about it. Is there a different way of thinking about the environmental crisis apart from the fact that it refers to us, an anthropocentric conception? Can we say, for instance, that the environment is being degraded of itself? And if we can, what on earth does that mean? I just simply stated that last time. I don't believe I gave you any more detail about that. I want to suggest three ways in which we might think about the environment in and of itself as being in a state of crisis. And the third way, which I intend to get to toward the end of the lecture, will be based upon something that I will get out of Paul Taylor. I propose to read you actually quite a lot of this book today, because what he says is very interesting. And it strikes me that he can explain what he's trying to tell you as well as I can, so I just read bits of it. That's going to come later. There are three ways I'd like to try to explain in a bit more detail how the environment can be in crisis in and of itself. Let's try the first way and say, well, it's becoming polluted. Polluted. What does that mean? Well, I'm going to come back to that in a second, because I want to say a bit more about those four causes of the environmental crisis. And when I refer to the first one, what I call the thermodynamic level, that will help us understand a little bit more what this means. Because we don't want, of course, to simply understand this to be polluted from our point of view. If that's all we meant by it, then we'd be back on this anthropocentric position. And we'd like to try to have a different conception of the environmental crisis for that. We'd like to have an environmental ethic which is not an anthropocentric ethic. This can all be dealt with at the anthropocentric level, of course. We can develop an environmental ethic where the environment's something good for us. We can think about the environmental crisis in terms of ourselves. We can conduct all of that in terms of standard ethics. We don't want to do that. That's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to think of ways in which we might be able to extend our ideas about value, not just to us as members of Homo sapiens, maybe not even just to animals, but further on again. So that's what we're doing in broad sweep terms in this set of lectures. So if we understand polluted just to mean, well, I don't like the smell of the air, or it makes my washing dirty, or it makes me cough, or I don't like the way it looks, well, that's referring back to me again. So we would perhaps like some other conception of that apart from my point of view. Second way, I don't know what you think of this as a conception. These are all things which, how shall I put it, I'm putting forward to you. I haven't read these anywhere. These are ideas of mine. I don't know if anybody else has written about this. Second way, we might suggest that it's the breakdown of natural order. Now, what does that mean? Well, I suggest that that is inspired by ecology. If we think of natural order in this sense, I'll put it in scare quotes, natural order in this sense, as the sum of relations which hold between individuals, that is not just Homo sapiens individuals, but individual living organisms, if these relations begin to break down, we might wish to say that the environment in which these relations are supposed to hold is in some kind of crisis. Now, what about some mundane examples? Suppose I like fish, and I eat fish. Okay, I'm related to fish, that's a relation between me and fish. I eat them and they try to avoid me, presumably. Now, if the fish I'm trying to eat get full of mercury, I'll stop eating them because it's bad for me. Maybe that's good for the fish, I doubt it. So the relationship between Forge eats fish is something that will start to break down in an environment where fish are full of mercury. And that same relation between people eating other people, which of course is, as far as I can understand, the total essence of ecology, those sorts of relations will start to break down when some of the bits in the food chain become full of things like heavy metals. Pelicans can't keep eating fish if fish are full of mercury. When pelicans lay their eggs and the pelicans are full of mercury, well, in case of some birds, anyway, with pesticides, the eggs break when they sit on them because the calcium is too thin. So the relationship between a bird and its eggs is beginning to break down. If people go and shoot alligators in the Everglades, alligators can't lie there going, and make nice little depressions in the Everglades so other little animals can kind of live in those depressions. It can't protect the birds that would otherwise have predators and so on and so forth. So one might have a conception of an environmental crisis in which there's a breakdown of natural order and the environment is no longer what it was. The relations which hold between the individuals and the species which live in that environment are no longer what they were. I don't know whether that makes any sense to you. Yep. Thank you. what an intelligent class we have here. So there's a conception of an environmental crisis which perhaps might mean a bit more to you than just talking about it being polluted. Taylor has a third one, and we'll come to the third one a little bit later. These are not necessarily independent. Okay, so I'm trying to talk about a conception of environmental crisis in two senses. One, the anthropocentric one, and secondly, another one of the environment for itself. Think about that. Okay, so that was one point I was talking about last time. which is not too different from number two there. So what I was doing last time was suggesting that if we are to respond to the environmental crisis, we might like to understand what the cause is. And if we know what the cause to something is, then we can respond to it. If we don't know what the cause is, we blunder about in the dark, so to speak. These causes or reasons or explanations, I suggest we can think of them in four different levels. And the thermodynamic explanation, I ended last time with a little exchange with Guy about this matter here, is something which is at the level of just the natural processes which are at work here. And what the thermodynamic explanation is telling us is that the activities that the production system is implementing here are such as to provide us with, well, a semi-irreversible problem. It tells us this for several reasons. Let me give you one reason for it, which is something that you'll know about, which I think is nevertheless instructive. Suppose you have a fire in winter and you put your fire on, and that fire puts out some heat, energy. You're happy about that. It's an electric fire, so what's happened is that electric energy has been turned into heat energy. It's come from a power station, so mechanical energy has made it into the electric energy, which has gone to the heat energy, and that mechanical energy is due to a turbine, which has been driven by steam, which has been created by burning coal, which is essentially chemical energy. So the nice thing about energy is it's interconvertible in this kind of way. The nasty thing is there's a loss in this case. There's a loss of efficiency. So if you burn 100 kilojoules here, you might get 85 kilojoules of useful mechanical energy, because thermodynamics tells you that these processes are never 100% efficient. You might then get 80 kilojoules of electricity, which might turn out to give you 75 kilojoules there. So you've lost some energy that way. And you can't get it back either. This process of going from heat back to chemical energy is not going to work unless, again, you have some drop in efficiency. It might go back to 75 kilojoules here if you use the heat from your electric fire somehow to somehow create some other chemical. And again, it's not clear how you can do that. Maybe some kind of synthetic reaction. So whenever we use up energy in this way, we lose some of it. That's one of the things that thermodynamics tells us. We're losing energy in that way. Moreover, the energy that ends up, what's going to end up in this process if it's left to go, is heat. And it's going to end up at heat at a fairly low temperature. There's lots and lots of heat in the oceans. I mean, the oceans are very hot. They're not at a high temperature. There's many, many, many kilojoules of energy in the oceans, but the temperature's too low for it to be useful. Every time heat itself is used to do something, it has to fall from a higher to a lower temperature, as those of you that do thermodynamics know. So useful heat is fine if it's at a very high temperature. Something at 100,000 degrees centigrade. Do a lot of lovely work with that, you know, drive turbines, drive pistons, and so on. But as this heat falls down through a temperature gradient and gets to a low level, it's no good. It's degraded. It's useless. And thermodynamics tells us that. Tells us all of these things. It says, yeah, you can convert different forms of energy. You can turn them into heat. You can, in fact, in some ways, turn them back again. But in the process of doing it, A, the process is inefficient necessarily. You'll lose some energy. And B, eventually, the heat will be degraded down to a low level, and it's therefore useless. And you can't get it back unless you somehow put even more energy into the system. So the point is that when we use energy, which is stored in nice forms, we get it back in a lousy form that's no good to us once we've used it. So once you've used that chemical energy and it's been burnt in the form of coal and gone through some process, this might be an industrial process, it eventually ends up in a form of low temperature heat, which is no good. It's gone, finished, goodbye, end of it, can't be used again. Thermodynamics tells us that. So not only is there no perpetual motion machine, the machines that we make are not only not perpetual, but they're continually degrading of the kind of energy sources that we've got. If this was all somehow replaced by an outside source, say from the sun, things wouldn't be too bad. So I'll leave that to one side. It's unlikely that that will happen, I think. So with regard to the processes that thermodynamics is telling us about, these laws are iron laws of physics, and you can't do anything about them. There's a second thing which thermodynamics tells us, which is worth mentioning, and it's this. In any natural process in a closed system, the entropy of that system will tend to increase unless it's compensated for by an input of even more energy into the system. And entropy is really just a measure of disorder. You can think of it that way. It has a molecular interpretation. But we can think of it as a measure of disorder. And if we can rephrase the second law of thermodynamics, which has a number of formulations, by saying this, that if you leave a system to itself, it will tend to reach a state of maximum disorder, unless you kind of continually tinker with it. So if you have a room and you open a little box of gas in the corner, maybe a gas you can see like bromine, then what thermodynamics says is that little molecules, once they get out, will tend to become distributed all over the box, until eventually there'll be an even distribution throughout. They won't all stay in the corner. This has a couple of messages. One is, you can't clean up pollution very easily, particularly if it's in gaseous or liquid form. This would be true if you drop some liquid into an ocean or a stream. It would still distribute in this way. It doesn't just stay there. If it did, well, okay, we could just pick it up and take it away and deal with it easily. But if you open something into the atmosphere, it will disperse. Now, somebody can probably tell me this. How many molecules, air molecules, am I breathing in of Caesar's Et tu, Brute, clunk? Have I lost you all? You know what Caesar said, the last guy that knifed him? Et tu, Brute, and you, Brutus? Brutus, his friend? Et tu, Brute. Now, let's assume that when he said Et tu, Brute, these molecules all became dispersed, you know, and weren't too absorbed. Oh, three or four or five, I'm breathing in and out. Now, if those molecules had all stayed around the Forum in Rome where they got him, I wouldn't be breathing them in and out. They've been distributed all over the world uniformly, we assume. This is true of things like nuclear fallout. It's all well known. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that once you start doing something in a system, or even if you don't do anything to the system, it'll tend to become disordered. So any kind of process which is going on, such as me taking the lid off something, or more interestingly, me firing up a power station or a chemical plant, the products of that will tend to get in a disordered state. We like to think about pollution in that way, as the addition to the systems that we like, of things that weren't there before, and they become polluted because these things just uniformly distribute over the system. You can't clean them up very easily. If you do want to clean them up, it costs you a lot in terms of energy. So they kind of got you both ways. You want to stick a lot more energy back into the system, you're going to use the energy up to clean up the mess, but entropy will sort of get you if you don't do that. So one of the things that thermodynamics does is kind of explain that once you embark on large-scale industrial processes which have throughputs of resources, you can think of an industrial process as taking something, adding energy to it, and converting it to something else. Those processes are going to, A, use up lots of energy, you can't get the energy back, and it's going to tend to increase disorder. Hence, it's no surprise that resources are being depleted at an ever more rapid rate as the industrial techniques of production really get moving, as we stay on this train out of control on the tracks, which is going faster and faster. So thermodynamics is explaining to us at this level that once you set up the techniques of industrial production, you're going to have problems with regard to the environment in this sense. Things are going to be lost which you can't get back, and it's going to tend to get polluted. So I guess when I'm talking about pollution there, we can think about some kind of disordering of the environment, particularly with regard to the things that we don't want it to have. Gases that we don't like CFCs, metals that we don't like mercury, gases in the atmosphere, mercury in the water, various sorts of other chemicals in the soils and so on. They'll disperse. A polluted environment is one where all these nasty things are being dispersed. And that is one of the causes, of course, of the breakdown of those sort of natural orders. That's one of the causes. Another cause, of course, is what requires of the resources that are being taken away, the local causes of that. So that's why I think it's worth bearing this in mind and why thermodynamics is helpful. Now, the second point, again, I'm just going over some things I said last time. The second point I think is worth making is that we understand the nature of these processes. You can think of thermodynamics as governing these processes. We can think of a process of smelting iron, you know, Fe2O3 and so on. That's a particular process which is governed by thermodynamics. Thermodynamics tells us that we add the carbon and get stuff out, that this carbon's gone for good, it's degraded eventually to low-level heat, and secondly, that the CO2 that comes out is going to become maximally distributed within the system. So this is a particular process, like every other natural process, it's governed by the theory of thermodynamics. We understand both of these things, we understand the particular processes, and we understand thermodynamics. If we didn't understand the processes, of course we couldn't implement the knowledge in the techniques of production. We understand that. Part of the explanation of a different sort then of the environmental crisis is that we've come to know things like how to smelt ferric oxide to produce iron and steel. And talking about what can be done, you can't do anything about the thermodynamic level because those are iron laws of nature. I don't think there's much we can do about this either, because we can't forget about what we've come to know. That is poignantly illustrated by horizontal proliferation, the nuclear sense. People are not forgetting after the Cold War how to make nuclear weapons. They're learning how to destroy some of the old ones, but they're not forgetting how to make new ones. So it now looks like Pakistan has got some nuclear weapons, and North Korea has, and the Americans are making new and more efficient ones, and I think it's Bob Dole is talking about having a Star Wars system. Now, we thought we'd seen the end of that, but evidently not. It seems to me that once one's known how to dominate nature, one doesn't forget it. So it's not as if we can somehow respond to the environmental crisis by forgetting things like this. Seems very strange that we can't, that suggestion. Well, we might try to do something else. Although we can't forget the physics, we might try to do something about the particular institution which is generating all of these difficulties, as I suggest, the so-called logic of industrial production. I don't think that one can do that. I think that the industrial system has its own dynamic, its own raison d'etre. I think it's the drive for economic growth, which is the raison d'etre of the industrial system. Its intention and its whole purpose is to churn out more and more goods and services. And that is precisely what is causing these problems, the churning out of more and more goods and services. That's what it's all about. It's churning out things that are supposed to satisfy not just our needs, but also something less clear to me, our wants. In fact, it's not only doing that, it's creating wants that we never knew that we had, and it's satisfying them. I never knew 20 years ago I wanted a personal computer. Now I don't even know how many I've got. I've got about 5, I think. I didn't know I wanted one till the industrial system provided me with one and said, oh, you can have one of these. I thought, oh, funny that, I didn't know I wanted one. Now I clearly do. About 10 years ago, I didn't know, well, 5 years ago, I didn't know I wanted one with a CD-ROM drive. I mean, I didn't know they existed. Now I know they exist, and of course I want one. The industrial system is a wonderful thing. It not only provides me with things I want, but it actually tells me I wanted them in the first place. Here's me not knowing this at all. So the industrial system not only can provide goods and services, it's a wonderful kind of psychologist. It can diagnose your wants, even though you didn't know you had them. Of course, I'm being sarcastic here. I don't think the industrial system is liable to moderate itself in the light of the environment. It strikes me the industrial system is precisely a system which is going to tend not to moderate itself in the light of the environment because its focus is not the environment. What it might do, though, is this. It might call upon a group of people called environmental economists, and it might say, well, can you do something about this problem for me? People are complaining about what I'm doing to the environment, and I want to respond to it. How can I respond to it? Can you guys, who've been so helpful in the past about justifying my activities, help me on this one? So what might be a consequence of that is environmental economists might come and say, well, what we have to do with the environment is to take it away from being a free good and incorporate it into the economic system. Put a price on it. So if guys want to pay for cleaner industrial processes will simply raise the price of the outputs of the industrial system. So, for instance, if it costs $10 for one particular artifact made in one way, let's suppose it can be made for $15 by means of a technique which is less polluting, and we'll let people make the choice. After all, the consumer's sovereign here. If they want to pay $15 for this item rather than 10, and they know that if they're buying this sort of super green product here, then it'll be less bad for the environment, then we'll let them do that. So we'll set up a theory for you as to how we can incorporate the environment into the economic system. And then we can make people make a free choice as to whether they want to have a polluted environment or not. So this is one way that the industrial system might respond to the environmental crisis, by setting up its own little system of economics to do that. Well, yes, right. Does it really work? Well, it's just putting off the inevitable for a start. And secondly, of course, this kind of economics is as voodoo as any other kind of economics. As if you can price something rationally like clean air. I mean, it doesn't seem to be this kind of thing that you can price. So there is, I must confess, one particular response that might be made within the context of number C, which would be to set up a system of environmental economics, such as I believe one learns in my friendly faculty next to me here at great length. But I'm kind of not too, I don't think that's going to be the thing that's going to help us with the environmental crisis, having green products. And then the last one is with what I call the ultimate values explanation here. And this is where we have our interest. And this particular explanation of the environmental crisis, or element of it, or way of looking at it, seems to me where we have some room to maneuver. And I've suggested that we might think of this this way of looking at it in two sorts of ways. We first of all got this key assumption of anthropocentrism, anthrop, up here, which is the key and defining value that it's us that's important and nobody else is. Once you've been given that, then the question is, well, what are we all about? What makes us happy, etc.? And so we then have within that context the values of consumerism / materialism. And again, as I was saying last time, these things tell me that I'm happy when I'm having wants satisfied that I didn't even know I had. So what makes humans happy is a satisfaction of certain material wants and needs. And that, of course, is precisely what the industrial system pumps out. It pumps out the ability to consume and be material. That's what the industrial system is good at. It doesn't pump out kind of abstract value or ideas, anything like that. That's not what it pumps out. It pumps out stuff we can buy and consume. It pumps out stuff which is material. And our standard of living is measured by the extent to which we can latch onto these values. So the way that one then responds at this level is to challenge both of these. One might want to say, well, no, I don't like these things. I like to go bushwalking and I like to sort of have free time. I like a clean environment. That's one way to respond. And if one believes that it's only us that has any value at all, that's the only way you can respond to the environmental crisis. You've got to attack it at this level, because you've accepted this. That's one way to respond. We're not going to do that in this course. We're going to try to respond at this level and suggest that perhaps the set of values, or the big value represented here, is not the only alternative. Now, we've done this already by talking about animals to some extent and suggest that it's not just us that has value and therefore has moral consideration. We suggest animals as well. Can we extend that further and get a conception of consideration which could apply to the environment itself or some bits of it, which will let us kind of attack this value here? That's all we can do in this kind of course. You want to know what the purpose of the course is. I mean, we can't sort of start going and sabotaging the industrial system and blowing things up. We can't go and change the laws of thermodynamics. We can't really go into the industrial system and change that, I don't think. But what we can at least do is to see whether there are any moral arguments to suggest that there's something wrong with this process. Something wrong not just in relationship to us as members of Homo sapiens, but wrong in a different sense. Wrong in a sense in which applies to the environment itself and not to us as people that live in it. Okay, so that's again sort of the time I finish setting the agenda, it'll be time to end the course. So that's kind of a framework, and I hope that might be a bit less unhelpful to you. So I move on now to consider one response that one can make at that level, an alternative to anthropocentrism, and this is called biocentrism, which suggests that it's not us, which are in the center, but living things. And that comprises more than necessarily just animal organisms, but other kind of organisms as well. Now, I want to talk about Paul Taylor and see how he operates here. He begins with something that strikes me.